Hello, welcome to a fresh episode of Sons of the Double Cheeseburger. I'm Brandon. I'm here with Kevin. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. I have something new that happened this week. Can I tell you what it is?
I wish you would.
Yeah, I dyed my hair.
Did you really?
Green. Yes. Yes, I did. Because I was bored, and
sure.
Because I'm a father who likes to really invite his son with autism, to make active choices. So when we were in the store picking up prescriptions and walked past the hair coloring, and I said, "Zach, if Dad colored his hair, what color should he make it?" And he grabbed the bottle with, or the box with green. And I said, "All right, you made a choice. There we go."
That's cool.
It's only hair. I can always shave it off.
That's true.
Actually, I shaved all the sides, and then I dyed the top green. So if I want to, I could cut it down to like a flat top and just have like a putting green on top of my head. In fact, I'm now tempted to do that, but we'll see. How's your week been?
My week's been pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah, I don't think there's been anything particularly exciting going on.
Yeah.
I did go to the grocery store today because we needed groceries.
Yeah.
And it was raining. It's been raining all day. And we've not gone to Costco because for some reason there's been lines all the way around the building.
Oh,
Costco,
yeah.
For the last 4 or 5 weeks, whatever the case may be.
Right.
But because it was raining, people did not want to line up outside Costco.
Nice.
So we were able to walk right in.
There you go.
And I'm amazed by how many people still do not wear just go to the simple step of wearing something over their piece of cloth over their mouth and nose.
Right.
People who just walk right, I'm standing looking at something on a shelf, people that walk right up next to me and just stand there and look at it too. They don't stand back and wait, you know.
I think a lot of people still have a hard time taking it seriously. And that's kind of amazing to me that in Illinois you're having that problem, considering you guys have been pretty hard hit by all of this. I mean, I know, like, out here, it's now, like, they can't serve you. I actually went through a drive-through the other day, and I pulled up to the window. It didn't even occur to me that I had to do this, but I pulled up to the window, and I went to hand the guy my credit card, and he said, "Sir, first I need you to put your mask on. I can't serve you until you put your mask on."
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah. So... so out here, but honestly, I'll agree with you. Out here, we still get some folks like that, and now it's, you know, they've said that businesses are not supposed to serve people, are not supposed to let customers in and without masks, and you'll see people wear the mask, and as soon as they come inside, they'll take it off, and yeah. So there are some people that just do not, they don't believe it. I think there are some people that just don't. I mean, apparently 60,000 dead people isn't convincing enough, but that whole thing that we were hearing where it's like it's not going to be as bad as the flu, now that we're up past what would be typically like the high end of deaths in a flu season,
right.
We'll probably
over the course of 2 months, right?
Over the course of 2 months, right?
Over the course of 2 months where everyone's been staying at home.
Correct, and with no clear end in sight. So we should probably be done with that now.
Yeah, we won't be.
I mean, we'll get some other argument, but we should be done with that one. So.
I did tell a guy to step back.
That's good.
He came up close to me, and I gave him a dirty look and said, "Step back." And he looked at me for a second, and I did like a little hand thing, like, you know, like waving him back.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he stepped back, and he mumbled something, and I said, "Pandemic, buddy." And that was it. Because I get a little anxious out there, too. I mean, like, I came home from going shopping, and I, you know, my shoulders were all tense, and, you know, it's not because I panic about this. It's just that it is a bigger deal than anything else we've had to deal with in our lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, we would have lost World War II if it was being fought right now with the level of sacrifice that was needed then.
I don't even want to imagine. No.
We'd be speaking German.
Actually, it's good if they let us speak at all.
German or Japanese.
No, one or the other. Yeah. And for that, you could go to Amazon and watch Man in the High Castle. They should make another season of that. That is just, this is what would have happened if this generation had been at the war. So
now, did you watch that show all the way through? All seasons?
Not all the way through, because at some point it started to take like a sort of weird, like, I don't know. It took a weird turn that lost me.
Yeah, I mean, I'll watch just about anything with Nazis in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I, you know, enjoy seeing the Nazis get their comeuppance. But it's I stopped because, and you know, I could probably go back into it and pick it up again. My frame of mind at the time was, I was not prepared for what it was offering. So,
yeah, I think it was maybe end of the second season or third season, something like that. There started to be just some sort of like weird, like, I don't know, X-File-y kind of stuff to me. It felt like, and I was like, no, this is not what I came for.
Well, that was Philip K. Dick, right?
It was.
So,
but I don't think that in his original story there was any of that.
Yeah, I haven't read the story. I think I should do that.
So, there you go. Read a book. And folks,
when
you buy that book, folks, buy it from a local bookseller. That's just
a great idea.
Plug for local booksellers as opposed to Amazon, because Jeff Bezos has enough.
He does. I think he's doing okay.
And Jeff, if you're listening to our podcast today and you want to come on the podcast to explain why you don't have enough, we would be glad to have you come on.
And Jeff, it will cost you $1 million per person in America to come on our podcast.
Ooh, I like that.
And you can, per family, I don't know. Yeah, that's one of those things, like billion, and you know how big billion is?
Yeah.
Like, if you were to divide up Jeff Bezos' fortune, which is like $130-some billion, right?
Yeah.
How much could every person in America get if you split that evenly?
Oh, good question. Wait a minute, hang on. How much do we think it is? $135 billion?
Yeah.
I'm using my telephone right now, and there's, what are we going to say, 350 million people in America?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so this is the bad news. If you do that, every person in America gets $385.71.
All right, it'll cost them $300 per person in America to come on our podcast.
So you're going to leave him with 85 times 325 million.
Yeah, that's still leaving him with a pretty significant sum of money, it seems, right?
That would still leave him with $27 billion. What the? The numbers are insane. They're really unmanageable. I got lost when I thought about it for a while, when at one point, and the numbers have probably been revised, but early in this whole situation, officials in Seattle were saying that the shutdown in their city was going to cost the workers in the local economy $1 billion. And I thought to myself, well, there's somebody who lives there who could just give that $1 billion and wouldn't even notice.
Right, it'd be a rounding error.
So...
Yeah, this is an argument that we're walking right up to the line of going someplace different with it, and I don't think we should.
Yeah, no, we're not going to do that. It's a and for everyone else, Kevin and I talked about things related to pandemic and stay at home for about 45 minutes before we started this, just to try to get it out of our system. So you got spared all of that. You're welcome. But what we wanted to talk about today, as Kevin said, when I mentioned books, he said, speaking of books, we both read a book that we wanted to talk about a little bit. And the book is called 10 Innings at Wrigley. And it's by a guy named Kevin Cook. And it is about a single baseball game that happened between the Chicago Cubs and the Philadelphia Phillies on May 17th, 1979. So yeah, it's timely and it's universal.
Well, I mean, we, to be fair,
but we
many
like
of
it.
Our conversations when you and I would might talk,
yes,
would at some point involve discussion of baseball.
Yes, they would.
Some of them involve just baseball.
And at this time of year, most definitely, yes.
Right. So we're trying to scratch a baseball itch here.
Very much.
And we've been trying to avoid just talking about baseball all the time because perhaps not everyone wants to talk about baseball all the time.
But then
we
realized
trick ponies.
We still want to talk about baseball.
We do.
We do.
So our mother gave us this, each of us this book for Christmas, right?
Yes, that's correct. And so I read it a while ago, and you just finished reading it pretty recently. And so we thought, let's talk about it a little bit. Can I give people who don't know anything about like why there would be a book about one single game? Can I give a little background? Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we need to set the table on this.
So the point is that this was the highest scoring baseball game in modern baseball history.
Right.
And again, it was just an ordinary day between the Cubs and the Phillies. Actually, now, the Cubs and Phillies... Yeah, go ahead.
Interesting side note, right? The highest scoring game in Major League Baseball history is also between the Cubs and the Phillies.
That is correct.
Was that 26-23? No, what was the score of that one?
You know, I'm going to check while we're talking about this. So I think...
So we can come back to that.
Yeah, I think it was... I do believe the winning team had 26 in that game, but I don't remember what the losing team had.
So this game happened... Well, you were setting this up.
26-23, you were right, yeah.
Okay.
In 1922.
Yep.
So this game was... So first of all, it was notable because it was so high scoring. It was also notable just because there was... I mean, in a game where that sort of thing happens, there's going to be a lot of weird stuff. In this particular game, 13 of those runs got scored in the first inning. So, but there was just... It was a wild, wild game. And it was a day game, because again, this is 1979, this was in Chicago, so that was before there were lights at Wrigley Field. So, one of the things I was thinking about, Kevin, was that we probably saw some of this game on TV.
Yeah.
I'm almost certain we did, but I'm also certain that we didn't see the beginning, because we would have still been in school.
Right. Right. I mean, it's interesting to note that early season games at Wrigley. Now, Wrigley Field used to be a bit more of a hitter-friendly park than it is now.
Yeah.
In part because now the bleachers have been expanded, which did some things to the wind, the wind swirls in the stadium. And, of course, now they've got the...
The extra boards, the video boards.
The extra video boards. And I think it probably had some effect putting all those bleachers up on top of all the buildings outside of the park.
I think so, yeah.
So I think there was a lot of ways in which the park used to kind of create like a bit of like a wind tunnel, and under certain circumstances, the wind would come from the lake into the park and then push it out?
Well, see, it would come all different directions. So at times it did. I mean, they would talk about, sometimes they would say the wind was blowing in or blowing out to left field, sometimes it was blowing out to right field, sometimes it was blowing across from one to the other. Sometimes it was just blowing straight in. I think those are when it was really coming off the lake.
But May was not typically as high scoring. You didn't see that factor as much early in the season because it was cooler.
Right.
But apparently this was a unseasonably warm day.
Yeah. So it's a crazy game. And again... And the other thing is there are a lot of players, like some really noteworthy players in the game, some of whom had really big days. Pete Rose was a part of this game. Mike Schmidt, who's a Hall of Famer, was in the game. Bruce Sutter was a Cubs relief pitcher very early in his career at that point. And then some other players who were not Hall of Famers but still had big games, including Dave Kingman, who was one of the Cubs' big stars at that point. Stars as being a relative term because the Cubs of the late 1970s were not exactly a juggernaut.
No. They were middling. I think that's a good way to describe them.
I believe in 1979 they finished 81-81, which is about as middling as you can be.
Or 80-82, maybe? I think it was 80-82.
Was it?
I think it was. Mm. But, you know, it's interesting because you look back, and I have this memory, you know, there's this notion that existed that the Cubs were dreadful in our time growing up.
Right.
Through the 70s. But when you look back at their record from season to season, they were really more average than terrible most of the time.
Yeah. You're right. They were 80 and 82, by the way.
Yep. I'm on a roll today.
You are on a roll. But yeah, it was mostly just, I mean, there were a couple of really bad seasons.
Yeah.
But it was mostly just a lot of average, a lot of mediocre, which I think is also where, you know, I don't know if you remember this, Kevin, they used to hear people talk about the June swoon. You remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the Cubs would have some years where they would start out well, and then just it all came back to earth, and they became non-competitive for the second half of the season.
Yep.
So anyway, so let's do this. let me ask you, what'd you think of the book?
I thought it was good. I enjoyed the inning by inning kind of recap.
Yeah.
That was good. At the end, where there was a bit more, where there was some focus on individual players.
Yeah.
That were considered to perhaps be especially interesting characters.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that I liked. Some of that wasn't as interesting to me, but like I really was not terribly interested in Tug McGraw's story. I don't have anything against Tug McGraw, but, and you know, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but you know, it was
Yeah. No, I agree.
It was a character. He was a character, but, you know, it wasn't necessarily a huge issue. I thought...
Plus, he wasn't one of our guys.
Well, right. The Dave Kingman portion was... I mean, Dave Kingman basically ran himself out of the game.
Yeah.
You know, he was... Dave Kingman, likely, had he not been a complete...
Uh-oh, I might have to learn how to use the edit button. We're talking about Dave Kingman. Do your best.
He was not a... completely disagreeable human being.
There you go.
Prone to despicable acts. Mm-hmm. He would have likely hit over 500 home runs.
Probably.
And it probably would have been tough to keep him out of the Hall of Fame. As it stands, other than people who played during the that steroid era, people that have been accused of using performance-enhancing drugs, right? He has the most home runs.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact,
a non Hall of Fame player.
Right, and at the time that he retired, it was at the time that he, I mean, you're talking about 500 now. At the time that he retired, 400 was already such a line. There were no people who had more than 400 home runs who were not in the Hall of Fame, and so I remember actually there was already some discussion at that point, like, I mean, people saying this guy's not a Hall of Famer, but there's nobody who's ever hit this many home runs who isn't a Hall of Famer. But the rest of his game was pretty lacking other than a couple of seasons, one of which happened to be 1979. He was a giant in 1979. Had a really, really good season. Easily the best season of his career.
And relatively well-behaved in 1979.
Yes. So he was able to hold it together for one whole year, pretty much.
I mean, yeah. Dave Kingman was a Chicago area boy as well. Went to Prospect High School, yep, right?
That's right.
Same high school as
our mother,
my spouse, and our mother, right? Yeah. Who are two different people, despite my slip up last week.
They sure are. Yes, they are.
I know they're different people.
Yep. Did your therapist help you work that out this week?
No, no, he thought that was funny.
That's good. But yeah, so he was a local guy, went to local high school, went off to college, played in a bunch of places. But yeah, had a history. Dave Kingman had this huge history of being just not worth the trouble. That's a way to put it. In fact, one of my favorite things about Dave Kingman, I don't know if you remember this one. Actually, I think they mentioned it in the book, but they didn't make a huge deal of it. Dave Kingman had one season, I'm pretty sure it was 1977, where he played for four different teams in 1 year. And it was especially notable and quirky because at that time there were four divisions in the major leagues. Each, the American League and the National League, each had an East and a West division. And the four teams were situated in the four divisions, one in each of those divisions. That was the kind of thing when I was a kid that I was that like really caught my attention. I was like, this guy played in all four divisions. And it didn't occur to me for a while that it was because he was such a giant putz that no team could put up with him that year. Seemingly.
Right, yeah. It was, and that, you know, that makes me think that was the sort of thing where you would look at, we'd look at baseball cards, for instance, and turn it over, and you've got the stat line in the back, and it was the sort of thing that would stand out to you because you would see 1979 listed multiple times.
Yep.
Or his baseball card. I don't even know from that year what uniform he was wearing on his baseball card, but it clearly wasn't the uniform he was wearing at the end of the season.
No. Well, because he played for, in 77, he played for four teams, and then at the end of the season got traded again. So that was how he ended up coming to the Cubs. In 77, he played for the Mets, for the Yankees, so he played for both New York teams, played for the California Angels, played for the San Diego Padres. So from literally from coast to coast, he was despised. And by now the way, Dave Kingman, if you're listening, we'd love to have you come on and just rehabilitate your reputation. Although I doubt we'd enjoy it.
You know what? I just think that, I don't know. I don't have I bet there's probably, if you know him, if you're in his circle of trust.
Yeah.
He's probably an all right guy.
Yeah, it's probably true.
I just think he was the sort of guy who just did not want to have to deal with stupid questions and people being in his face. He just wanted to play baseball and then go fishing, and that was it.
Yeah.
And in Chicago, they were going to bug him nonstop. In New York, where he had a lot of troubles, they were going to bug him nonstop.
Yeah.
So it's just a problem.
Yeah.
I don't know. Also, he could probably still bury me at whatever age he is right now. So
it's possible.
Because he was a monstrously strong individual.
Yes. Yeah, they talk about that. He's 71 right now, by the way.
He could still... Oh, he could easily still bury me.
Yeah.
I'm no Jack LaLanne anymore. No picture of fitness.
That's just... I'm going to hold out of that mental image. Maybe you could put on our Facebook page a picture of Jack LaLanne with your head on it for this week.
No.
That'd be great. I'd appreciate that. Thanks.
Jack LaLanne. All right. You know, from that same period, getting off subject a little bit.
Yeah.
Another story, because we were talking about Dave Kingman and all those trades in 1977.
Yeah.
My favorite trading story of someone being traded from that era.
Yeah.
Do you know what that, can you guess which one that would be?
Isn't it, was it Lenny Randle who got traded for himself?
No. Oh, that's right. No, I'm thinking of Joel Youngblood playing two different teams in the same day.
That's right.
And both pitchers, he got hits off of two different Hall of Fame pitchers that day in two different games.
That's great.
He got a hit off of Fergie Jenkins, and he got a hit off of Steve Carlton.
It's a good day.
Yeah. So So that is my favorite. But
that's a good
traded
one.
For himself. That's Len Randle. There's another. That could be a whole podcast.
It might not have been Lenny Randle. Let me see. Let me see. John Odom was traded. Blue Moon Odom was traded for bats at one point. No, it wasn't. Okay, no. No, see, but I was wrong. It's actually, it was a Cub who was traded, one of the players who was traded for himself. There are four players who've been traded for themselves. Brad okay. Gulden, Dickie Knowles.
Oh, yeah.
Harry Cheedy, and John McDonald. Legends all.
Dickie Knowles had a, you know, he featured in some of those, Cub teams of this era, right?
He of did. Well, I'm thinking he had to be either on the Cubs or the Phillies in 1979.
I don't think he was on either, but...
Oh, you know what? Look at this. I'm looking at his page right now. He was, but he didn't make his major league debut until July 5th.
Oh, so after 79 this was game. His rookie season.
Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice.
But he didn't get there in time for this one. So what are you... So let's do this. Anyway, I think I would say, like, if you're somebody who likes baseball, and if you're interested, I agree with you. The way that he told the story, the author, he went inning by inning and walked you through what was happening, but also gave you some vignettes of key people, like people who had key roles in those innings. So that's right. How he filtered in a lot of that personal information. I thought that was a really, really interesting part. I agree with you that the legacies part at the last section was okay. Like, even the Dave Kingman part, maybe because I knew a lot of that stuff, it just, by the time you're at the end of the book, I'm like, now I feel like we're just beating up on the guy for being a tool.
Yeah, it was pretty clear he did not have a lot of regard for Dave Kingman or for Bill Buckner, necessarily.
Right, and which was, that leads me to the other question I was going to ask you. Like, what were things that surprised you? And that was one of them for me. Bill Buckner comes out of this book not looking real great, I don't think.
No, and, you know, I think maybe players back then were protected a bit more in terms of their public image.
Yeah.
And it took being a really disagreeable individual, somebody who just didn't care.
Yeah.
Like Dave Kingman, you know, who, despite any efforts on his behalf, was bound and determined to be himself and not... you know, get airbrushed, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But Bill Buckner, who was a player I admired growing up, and sounded like he really had trouble with the fact that he wasn't the best player on the team, and he didn't want to go to any effort to get along.
Right. He gets, and which, again, you've heard things like that. Like, I think about a later era of the Cubs, right? When it became clear that in the clubhouse that there were Sammy Sosa's guys and there were Mark Grace's guys. That was, like, really disappointing to me. That was really, I was like, oh, come on. Why did, you know? But it seems like that kind of thing happens. There's kind of factions develop in teams. And yeah, I had never heard a lot of that stuff about Buckner, but he came across, like, in this book as a pretty selfish guy. And not real interested in, like, building that team camaraderie.
Yeah, well, Herman Franks also came off quite poorly.
That's not as surprising.
Herman Franks, who was the manager of the Cubs, and that was his last job. He did not actually even finish that season. He quit with two games left in the season. Is that
that's
right?
Yes, he did.
That's
yep.
That's stand-up guy. Right there.
Herman Franks.
Just did not care.
No, I think he must have been paying something off and made his last payment and was like, I'm done.
Well, they talked in the book about how he apparently was a bit of a real estate mogul.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
had invested
that's right.
carefully in real estate and did not need the money from baseball.
Right.
And apparently then, absent needing the money, he could not find another motivation for giving a rip.
No, so, that's correct.
So he didn't.
No. Oh, so let's do... Yeah, go ahead.
The Phillies came across much better.
I thought
really
so.
There really wasn't anybody in the Phillies who... Ron Reed, Would that be the one guy?
Yeah.
Who they kind of talked about a little bit, like he was salty, but even just then it was kind of like, yeah, he wasn't the nicest guy. He wasn't the easiest to get along with.
Let's
but
do this.
It really feels like the Cubs, and you know what? It's probably fair to say that the Cubs deserved some shots, because we could go through all sorts of missteps and idiocies from that era of Cubs baseball. But
indeed.
It, at times, I felt a little bit like, wow, that's...
Yeah, they didn't... Especially considering that was our team. It was like, oh, they didn't...
Right, you're not hiding your loyalties, if you have any.
No, no. Let's do this. Let's take a break and then come back. Let's talk more about the Phillies. And there were a couple of Cubs that came through a little more sympathetically or, again, like learned some things that I didn't know about some of those guys. So yeah. After a break, let's grab some more of that. How does that sound?
That sounds lovely.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, we're coming back. And, again, so you want to talk about more things that surprised you about the Cubs or positive things you learned about the Phillies from this?
We can talk a little bit about the Phillies, because, I mean, I don't think we want to leave them out. What was interesting about this game, this was kind of a dry spell in professional baseball anyway.
Yeah.
In terms of interest and talent level and such.
Mm-hmm.
And this game is interesting because the two teams playing were perennial doormats. I don't think that people think of the Phillies right now necessarily as having at least as bad a track record of success as a worse track record of success.
Historically, yeah, right.
Right. I think at that point, they had never won a World Series.
That is correct.
I think they had been a team for like 88 years, 81 years or something, or longer than that.
Right.
When did the Phillies start? So they had...
The Phillies are one of the original franchises.
And they were probably the worst of the original franchises.
Yeah.
That was still around in 1979.
Yeah.
Historically the worst.
In fact,
but
I was reading something else
recently.
They
were a team that was getting better.
Yes. I was reading something else recently. This is an interesting thing. I read this in the in Society of American Baseball Research's journal that the Phillies actually have had the, in terms of official team name, have had their team name longer than any other team in Major League Baseball.
Right.
They've been named the Phillies since 1890. But yeah, I mean, well, and to be fair, like in the Phillies in the late 70s had started to really put it together.
Right.
So yeah, like you said, but they had like 3 years in a row, they won their division and they lost in the NLCS each time.
Right. And at that time, there was only one playoff series before the World Series.
That was it.
You had two divisions in each league.
Right.
The East and West. And they would play, and then those winners from the respective leagues would go to the World Series. It's worth mentioning because it's much different than it is now.
Yeah. This is basically in fact, I'm looking at this really quickly. The Phillies went to the playoffs in 6 out of 8 years, and this was right in the middle of that. And that would honestly be one of only two like strings of success in the history of the team. So,
right, the other was in the early 2000s, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So this was like their first real like run of glory. And the one thing, like the player that stands out for me the most from the Phillies out of this, I hate this. I know. Mike Schmidt destroyed the Cubs. But you know what? I like Mike Schmidt.
Yeah, he's
I kind of hate that I like him.
Of all time.
Yeah. A great third baseman. And I don't know if you've ever... I don't know if you hear or ever see when like they pull him in for stories. You know, most ball players, after they're retired... you know, the reporters will go to them and you get the classic, oh, in my day there was this and that, you know, and it was always, you know, it's always about how much we were so much better then. And Mike Schmidt is the opposite of that. Mike Schmidt is more often than not will say, well, yeah, these guys are amazing. I think that the game has continued to get better. He's like really, he's not somebody who believes that his day was the golden age.
Right, and he's made some mention of ways he would play differently now.
Yeah.
That, you know, what he admires about the game now in the sense that the game has learned to accentuate certain things that have a higher, you know, chance of providing, you know, impact that could affect the outcome of the game.
Yeah. Well, and to tell you the truth, like, you look at Mike Schmidt, and I think he is, in some ways, he's like he's a great prototype for the modern game. He wasn't a high batting average guy, but a lot of power and drew a lot of walks, and he played great defense. Like, yeah. You think about three things that are really valued in the modern game, but Mike Schmidt was doing those things in the 70s and the 80s.
So who are the three players from your lifetime watching the Cubs that you have most dreaded seeing come to the plate when they were playing our favorite boys in blue? Man. Mike Schmidt is one of them.
So for sure, Mike Schmidt is for sure the number one for me, and it's because it's like we were so young. This was the beginning of our fandom, and it was really. Like, all I ever knew was Mike Schmidt destroying the Cubs.
Yeah. He was a mythical figure of sorts.
Almost. Yes. Yes, he was.
Wearing that zip-up powder blue uniform with
right.
the red stripes on the side. Mm-hmm. That maroon helmet with that... I actually kind of like that kind of flowing pee from that era. Oh, my gosh.
I don't think there's any good way for me to edit that out. I apologize.
Okay.
Let's just keep
moving. I
guess
we need to talk about Moises Alou now, right?
There you go. No. Okay. Well, who else? Who else would I really dread coming to see coming to the plate? Oh, there's somebody like right on the tip of my tongue, and I can't.
You might be thinking of somebody that I would be thinking of.
So give me another one. You give me
from
one.
The Cardinals.
Yeah.
Still plays, but not for the Cardinals.
No, Pujols.
Yeah.
Albert Pujols was almost as big a nightmare as Mike Schmidt. Yeah. Ugh.
And who else? No, I don't have an obvious third one. I said three. I probably should have done two.
Those two and then I think it would probably be some
really,
Cub. It was probably actually a Cub going up to
tie. Player, I really did not like seeing Larry Boa come to the plate.
No.
When he was with
no. The third one. See, this brings it all together. The third one would be Jeff Blauser, because you remember when Jeff Blauser was a Brave, he hit the Cubs really well, and then he came to the Cubs, and they were like. Oh, yeah. No, he's a great hitter. He always hit the Cubs really well. He did so much damage to the Cubs. And then, as a Cub, continued to do damage to the Cubs. Like he was a secret agent for the Braves.
It's true.
Oh, wow.
We could probably do a search that would tell us the players with the highest lifetime batting average... against the Cubs.
Yes. I'm pretty sure on Baseball Reference I can find that. I don't know if I can find it right now. Let me see.
Another person that comes across relatively positively in the book, actually positively, even when discussing his you know, event of infamy, is Pete Rose.
Yes.
Even talking about Pete Rose being kicked out of the game for betting on his own team is treated in a very neutral way.
Mm-hmm.
And he is otherwise talked about in a real positive way in terms of what he brought to the Phillies, what his, you know, his role was for that team in terms of giving them a spark and trying to push them over the edge. Like,
mm-hmm.
take them to the next level. Maybe that's a better way of saying that, right? He so it's You know, it's I would have been interested to see if Steve Carlton had pitched in that game, how would they have described, how would he have talked about Steve Carlton?
Right.
Because Steve Carlton was a notoriously cantankerous individual, right?
I think it was cantankerous, but maybe more just like really on a different wavelength.
Yeah, like, just more disinterested or aloof. And
yeah. By the way, I did a search for best batting averages against the Cubs, and one of the names that popped up would definitely be another guy on our short list. So, Mike Schmidt and Albert Pujols, Ryan Braun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Both because he wrecks us, and just because the look on his face, he's just, ugh. I want to, you know, I realize this is going out to the world, but I want to punch that guy. And again, I'm sure he could destroy me, but I just, I want to slap the grin off of his face.
Yeah, he's a good player. He has had a fantastic career.
Mm-hmm.
He used to be a butcher in the outfield. He wasn't so much, I mean, he improved at things.
Yeah.
He was a pretty complete ball player. A really good player.
Yeah.
If he was on our team, he would have made our team better. In any instance
Absolutely.
In his career, being on the Cubs would have made the Cubs better. But there may not be a player I dislike more.
Right.
And that's even separating who he is from the despicable thing he did trying to ruin the life of an innocent person who had the misfortune of having to carry his urine around.
Right. Yeah. I don't know that we can unpack that whole story, but yes, if you don't know that story, then you could look up Ryan Braun wrongly accusing somebody of tainting his sample. Spoiler alert, he didn't.
Yeah.
So this is more telling than just batting average. So if you look at who had the best slugging percentages against the Cubs, because right. those are the people that really wreck you, that you're just like, oh, and they're doing damage all the time. So yeah, if you think about the top of that list, this is since 1908. Number one is Frank Robinson, who was before us, but yeah, of mm-hmm. course. Number
That's
two,
believable.
Yeah, number two, Albert Pujols. What? Number three, Willie Mays, again, believable, but before our time.
I would have liked to have seen Willie Mays wreck the Cubs. I would have liked to have seen Willie Mays play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What I would have liked is to have seen some of the winter leagues in Puerto Rico when at one point the Santurce team had, I believe, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, and Roberto Clemente in their outfield.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably the greatest outfield ever.
Yeah. That's easily like three of the maybe 10 best outfielders ever.
Right. Each of them at their particular outfield position is probably in the top three or five at that position all time.
Well, probably three at the worst. Because
Clemente is the worst of those three.
Yes.
And Clemente was clearly a Hall of Famer.
Right. And just a magnificent human being.
Right. Yeah. Well, and Hank Aaron is a magnificent human being, too.
Yes, he is.
Hank Aaron's a national treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Willie Mays,
for my money, is also I don't know if you ever, another book reference, by the way, really great biography on Willie Mays that came out a couple of years ago, maybe 5 or 10 years ago now, just really excellent, and it talks about all the nonsense, that's the wrong word, the injustice and the racism and stuff that he put up with, as a minor leaguer. And not so much when he was in New York, but then when they first came to San Francisco. But Willie Mays is just amazing. So the top of that list was Frank Robinson, Albert Pujols, Willie Mays. Number four, Mike Schmidt.
We talked last week about memory.
Yeah. Didn't fail us in this one. No.
It did not fail us in this time. No. We are...
And then, and this is where it even gets better, then the next guys, Ralph Kiner, Rogers Hornsby, Hank Aaron, Duke Snider, and then Ryan Braun.
Okay.
So those three in our lifetime, three best slugging percentages against the Cubs. And it certainly felt like it.
Now, I guess it's reassuring that that list could probably look similar to any other team
Most National League teams, yes.
that played, right, that's had the his same type of history, length of time.
Right.
And a few of those players ended up playing for the Cubs, right?
Hornsby played for the Cubs.
Didn't Kiner play like a
Kiner
season or
played,
so at the end?
yeah, I think just one season. Yeah.
Kiner's corner.
Kiner's corner. That's right. Yeah, that's what made me want to be a broadcaster as a young man. we would you 'cause again, like early 80s, it was cable TV. You could get the Cubs, you could get the Braves on TBS, and you could get the Mets on, I think, WOR.
Yep.
There were all cable stations and like basic cable packages, and after the game, like in Chicago, the post game show was called the 10th inning.
Yes.
In New York, I believe it was the post game that was called Kiner's Corner with Ralph Kiner. I remember that. That's so. Oh.
What was the one Atlanta called? Shut up, Skip Carey. Who cares?
I have no idea. I could care less. Yeah, you're right. I mean, all those guys, it's a murderer's row. The guys with best slugging percentage. It's funny when you look at batting average, you get a couple of people who are more like outliers. So
You see,
like,
I'm more interested in the outliers, in a sense. You
all
know, who
right.
is that guy?
So batting average, number one, Rogers Hornsby. Again, not surprising. It's a National League, and he actually, so he hit 364 against the Cubs, which is only, I think, about 10 points higher than his lifetime batting average. So basically, he just did to the Cubs what he did to everybody.
And is lower than the batting average he had when he played for the Cubs.
Yeah.
So, now. He has what is probably my favorite baseball-related quote.
Go ahead.
I want to make sure I don't butcher this. You know what I'm thinking of. Why don't you say it? Because I'm now getting it muddled in my head.
I don't know which one you're thinking of.
Oh, something along the lines of, "What do you do in winter?" He says, "I sit and I look out the window and wait for spring."
Yes, that's right. That's what he said.
Yeah.
Dude who would
It's
famously not read or again another there's a great biography of him, but would not read, would not go to movies because he believed they would damage his eyesight.
now, so there is a good biography of Rogers Hornsby?
There is, yeah.
I should read that.
Yeah, let me see. I was looking to see if I had it on my shelf here, but I don't. It's down in my garage. You know what I'll do? I'll give you links for some of these. We can put them in the notes, because yeah, there's a great Hornsby biography. The Willie Mays biography is awesome. I totally recommend it. Okay, so Rogers Hornsby, Paul Wehner, another
Oh,
Hall
yeah.
of Famer, and then we get obscure, Jack Fournier.
Let me guess,
Jack Fournier.
did he play in the 20s?
I'm going to have to look him up because that's how much I remember about Jack Fournier.
I'm gonna look up. I had.
1912 to 1927
Oh yeah.
was a White Sox, then was a Yankee, then was a Cardinal and a Dodger. He did have a lifetime batting average of 313, so he was not a nobody. But not that noteworthy.
All right, so who else do we have?
Then you got Chuck Klein, again, another guy who was a high average hitter from the late 20s and the 30s. Ernie Lombardi, maybe, like, other than Mike Piazza, maybe the best hitting catcher ever. Bill Terry, Hall of Fame first baseman.
Well, there is Pudge Rodriguez too.
Yes, but Ernie, yeah, well, so Ernie Lombardi, high, I guess I should be even more specific. High batting average, like among catchers who hit for high batting average. I think you've got like Lombardi, Piazza, Buster Posey, and Joe Mauer.
Did you point me in the direction of the Mike Piazza story about owning an Italian football or football soccer team?
I think I did.
That's a story.
Yeah.
And we're not going to talk about it.
We'll have to save that for another time.
We're giving you all work to do.
Yes, yes.
You can make some notes, look this stuff up in your own time.
Indeed. So Bill, next on the list was Bill Terry, who was last national leader to hit 400, by the way. Mm-hmm. Archie Vaughn, who was a pirate and probably should be a Hall of Famer. Richie Ashburn, who is a Hall of Famer. Ted Williams, who just made the Hall of Fame. Lou Brock. Did I say Ted Williams?
Who just made the Hall of Fame?
I meant Ted Simmons.
You said, because you can see why I thought you were being snarky about Ted Williams.
Plus, Ted Williams never played against the Cubs because he was in the American League. So Ted Simmons,
But we can be assured that he would have pounded the Cubs.
If Ted Williams had played against the Cubs, he'd be right up by Rogers Hornsby. That's where he'd be.
Oh, my God. He'd have hit. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, so Ted Simmons, yeah.
Ted Simmons. Lou Brock hit 334 against his former team. The next relatively obscure guy you get is Al Oliver. But not even that obscure. Al Oliver could be, I mean, he's like Hall of the Very Good.
I think of him as being a Ranger.
But he was also an Expo.
Oh, okay.
And did he maybe play for the Pirates, too? Let me see what I can get.
You know, when you read off these names, one of my favorite things to talk about, read about, is the old-time ballplayers.
Yeah.
Kind of that era up through even like World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's that golden age after World War II, and those are tremendous players. But it's those guys that really we don't even have any connection to. Because, you know, guys like Willie Mays and Frank Robinson, they still had some connection to the game as we were growing up.
Yeah.
So these were known quantities to us. We had a more recent point of reference to them.
Right.
But, you know, guys like Archie Vaughn, Bill Terry, and such, we didn't have any connection to them.
Right.
But the stories of baseball in that time, to me, are just endlessly fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Because you've got... There's so many different layers to that. Whether you're talking about the period of time where baseball was very much a gentlemanly game, right. You know, there's some really interesting pieces of that. Then you get the period of time where baseball is a very more rough and tumble thing. And those are some exciting.
Yeah, it was a real rogues game for a while there.
Yeah.
Players just quitting mid-season because they didn't feel like playing. They didn't like how much they were getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
Or they didn't like a teammate. You know.
Yeah.
It was
players getting
stuff.
Drunk and falling off of the team train and then falling in the river and dying.
Which player? I just read about him recently. Who was that?
Was
that mentioned in the book?
I don't remember if that's in the book. Isn't that Ed Delahanty?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I think it was mentioned in the book because he was one of the Phillies greats whose career was obviously cut short.
Cut short, yes. So Al Oliver started his career, played 10 years for the Pirates, but during the time when we were first becoming baseball fans, he had jumped over to Texas, played there, and then wrapped up with a couple of teams, so including the Montreal Expos, where he won a batting title.
Really?
Yes.
One of my favorite players also played for the Expos.
Yuppie?
Le Grand Orange?
Oh, Rusty Staub, yes.
You can make a case for Rusty Staub being in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you can. Well, you can make a case for Al Oliver. He ended up with 2,700 hits and a .303 batting average.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, you can definitely make a case for Rusty Staub. Yeah, Al Oliver's cool. I don't know where he lives now. We'll find him. We'll get him on the show.
Ha 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 ha.
I mean, Willie Mays lives pretty close to me, so I'm going to go try to storm his compound and do an interview with him.
Okay.
Rusty Staub, we can't do that because he's not with us anymore.
That's a shame.
Yeah. But yes, LeGrand
that
Orange.
Sounded like I didn't really think it was a shame. No, it's very sad.
It yes. More than yes, your first insincere take.
Ho-hum.
Jeez. Well, you know what they say. I mean, I believe actually the Texas Lieutenant Governor just set the tone for us on that. You know, there are things more important than living.
Rusty Staub regrets that he had one life to give for his country and can't give another one to.
That's right.
Let people go back shopping. All right, anyway, so.
I gotta tell
let's
you.
Get back to this 10 innings at Wrigley.
Bed Bath ain't gonna be on itself, my friend. Okay, so there was one more obscure player with batting averages that I want to share with you.
More obscure,
perhaps even than Jack Fournier. It's Danny Littweiler.
Yeah, that's the first time I've heard that name.
Played from 1940 to 1951, and didn't really ever do anything of note. Other than hit .333 against the Cubs.
So let's talk a little bit more, though, about Bill Buckner.
Yeah.
Because he was a player I admired growing up. Number 22.
Yeah.
The big...
won a batting title for the Cubs.
Mustache, right. Had horrible ankles.
Yes.
Right. And apparently he was a bit of a cur for a while there.
Mm-hmm.
But I have heard him more recently. He was in the booth for a Cubs game once, I believe.
Yeah.
And he seemed like a real genial, nice guy. And the stories about him that come out after what people probably know most about him, his error in the 86 World Series,
mm-hmm.
right? That the way he dealt with that was really very gentlemanly, and he had a bit of understanding eventually of why people focused on that, even if he wished they didn't.
Yeah.
But he was willing to then poke fun at himself. He was willing to talk about it. He appeared with Mookie Wilson once at a card show. You know, I mean, that's... He wouldn't do that if he was really just, like, a jerk.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So why was he a jerk, then, with the Cubs?
I don't know.
Was it because Dave Kingman was a bigger jerk?
Maybe. I mean, it's an interesting question. Because here's the other thing. Here's the other thing that they talked about in the book about Buckner that I definitely didn't know at that time. I don't think, again, you talked about the things we didn't know about players at that time. But I've learned it in the years since then. You talked about him having really bad ankles. And even that doesn't, like, that doesn't give it enough justice. I'm not saying Bill Buckner had an injury as a young player, like a horrific injury that was then mistreated. And I believe didn't he get a staph infection?
Yeah, he almost lost
in the injury. Right. So horrific injury and then mistreatment and could easily have lost his entire career. And when I thought about it, here's the thing that really struck me. The player that it made me think of reading both in this book and other times I've read about it in the past is Mickey Mantle. So
yeah,
Buckner,
did I was thinking as well.
Buckner and Mantle, both players who very young, at very young ages, had enormous talent, and in their early seasons had horrific leg injuries. Mickey Mantle stepped on a drain or a sprinkler head, and did damage to
his knee.
Yeah, shredded his knee. Again,
that was as a rookie,
right?
Wasn't it?
I believe
it was in his first World Series.
Yeah. And if it was the kind of thing that probably now they'd have done surgery, he'd missed a year, and he'd have come back. But they didn't. I mean, he was in horrific pain for the rest of his career. Buckner was in horrific pain for basically his whole career. two guys that, and again, Mickey Mantle, let's be fair, all-time great. I mean, Mickey Mantle is an elite player. Bill Buckner's not at that level, but Bill Buckner is, again, I think you can make an argument for him for the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's a strong case, but it's, there are, let's be honest, there are worse players. There are worse first basemen, I think, in the Hall of Fame than Bill Buckner. If Tony Perez wants to come on and tell us why he's not,
There are even worse Harold Baines in the Hall of Fame.
There are even worse. Let me be clear, though. If Tony Perez wants to come on our podcast and talk about it, he is not welcome. because my mind is made up on this one. But Bill Buckner was, I mean, so yeah, a great guy or a great player seemed like a really good guy later on. I don't know. I don't know whether it was that, like, Kingman was worse. I don't know whether it was the I mean, it sounds like Buckner was an incredibly competitive guy. And so playing on a team like the Cubs, and we haven't gotten into this very much, but the Cubs were so poorly run during that era. And by that era, I mean from like probably like 1930 until like 2014. So in that era, very poorly run. Maybe it wasn't until 40s that it really got bad. Yeah, but I mean, like super stupid stuff. Like you were saying, in 1975, they had a bad season. They fired the general manager, and they hired the guy who had been, or they promoted the guy who had been the head of concessions to be the general manager. That's insane.
Salty Saltwell, general manager of hot dogs.
Saltwell, yes. In the 1960s, they decided instead of having a manager, they would experiment with the College of Coaches. The worst experiment ever in baseball. The biggest failure. I can't think of, I mean, I can't even imagine a bigger failure or a stupider idea making it to Major League Baseball than that one.
And what's interesting, too, is many of those gentlemen continued to work in the organization.
Yeah. Well, actually,
one became the GM, right? Bob Kennedy.
Yes.
And Vitti Himsel stayed in the organization, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly.
Yep.
And who? There was another guy with an unusual name.
Oh.
Eparixi? No.
No, that's a different. He was a Reds pitcher earlier than that.
Oh, that's a weird name. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's okay. I'm going to find it. But it was, I mean, it's such an awful, awful idea. And so here's the thing. Not only is it an awful idea, but then it was also poorly executed. You're thinking of El Tappy.
Oh, yes.
El Tappy. Yes. So
I have an El Tappy baseball card.
Nice. Yeah. But yeah, the original College of Coaches was supposed to be El Tappy, Charlie Grimm, Goldie Holt, Bobby Adams, Harry Kraft, Verlin Walker, Ripper Collins, and Vitti Himsel. The idea was that they would rotate through the organization and spend some time as the major league manager, and then some time doing other things. What a stupid idea. and then here's the thing. If you go to Wikipedia, here are the Wikipedia sections on the College of Coaches. Section 1, concept. Section 2, chaos. It was insane. And then they, like, instead of it being like a straight rotation, they started changing it around, and, you know, just a nightmare.
Well, and they rotated in different people?
Yeah.
Over time?
Well, because Bob Kennedy wasn't originally part of it.
Right.
Then they brought him in, and then they just said, well, we're just going to stick with him now. Okay.
Stan Hack was part of the College of Coaches in 65. Elvin Dark.
How did it last until 1965?
Well, apparently there was a winning season in there, too.
What a nightmare.
Buck O'Neill was... So wait, does that mean Buck O'Neill was the first African-American manager?
Did he manage, like, a game?
From 62 to 65, he was part of the College of Coaches. Unless he was just one of the coaches who never was designated a manager for a day.
It's a big list there. including some of my favorite baseball names, Charlie Metro.
Joe Macco.
We could, honestly, we could turn this into like a 40-hour podcast on the stupidity of the Cubs management. But yeah, suffice it to say, bad management. So it might be that that's why, like, just fair listener, keep in mind that this the Cubs had been mismanaged for decades. And yeah, it might well be that Bill Buckner, who's a mega competitive guy and was playing at a pretty high level, and doing so in considerable pain and discomfort, just couldn't bear the idea that he was doing it for this nonsense organization and having to, like, fight for the clubhouse with a nitwit like Kingman.
Well, and Herman Franks, for that matter.
Yes.
Right? I mean, he came from the Dodgers, Buckner did.
Yes.
And the Dodgers...
And Franks came from the Giants, by the way.
Well, and Buckner, you know, coming from the Dodgers in that era, the Dodgers were, you know, they were a
well-run organization
of what an organization should be like.
Yes.
And so it certainly had to have been. It would probably be like going from
culture shock,
the Dodgers to the Marlins. I don't know. I mean, it had to have been.
I was going to say it would be like going from the Yankees to the Marlins, because I just wanted to think about Derek Jeter for a minute. Well, see, but that's the thing. Starting to talk about this just took us into all of those different things that, you know, sports of that time period. So, but no, I thought it was a great book, and I thought it was fun to think about a lot of that stuff. It was fun to learn things.
I learned things about Gary Maddux.
Yeah.
Who I think I always thought was a fine ball player, but you know, I did not know that he was a Vietnam War veteran,
right?
Who had been seriously injured by napalm.
Right.
Right. And that was why he wore a beard, because he had burns and his skin was very sensitive. You know, interesting stuff. There's the whole thing with Donnie Moore
and Ray Burris, both. I mean, a couple of really interesting people. And Donnie Moore's story is really a sad one.
It is.
You know, I don't want us to, I don't know if we've left enough time to dig too deep on it. I almost want to talk about this another time, but no, I mean, yeah, Donnie Moore was a player who worked hard, finally got his opportunity as an Angel, and then was part of another pretty epic failing in a high profile situation and never got over it and ended up trying to kill his wife and killing himself. Yeah, I mean, it's a horrible story. But I guess I did get into it after all. But yeah, I mean, it was again, he's another one in the book that to me, he's like a sympathetic figure.
Yes.
And that all went real, real bad for him. Yeah.
There, in the end, it was a book worth writing.
Yeah.
I think, because there are a lot of interesting people involved in that day of baseball.
Yeah. But yeah, I would definitely recommend 10 Innings at Wrigley if you like baseball, and particularly if you like the Cubs, or if you just like thinking about the 70s. And if you like thinking about the 70s, I don't know. I don't know what that's about. Eh. It might be just a respite from what we're doing now.
Didn't have any pandemics in the 70s.
You're right about that. Should we do a conclusion with manatee farts?
Yes. So, everyone, we have for you, this is like an old-time radio when people would have like the newspaper articles.
Page 2.
Things my daughter thinks we should know.
It's amazing, after all this time, we've only gotten to page 2. All of that was on page 1.
Manatees use their farts to move up and down in the water.
That's amazing. As I said to you, Kevin, the first time you told me that fact, it excites me to know that there's another species that knows how to do something productive with its gas.
There's also another species that has an odd, like, lumpy, like, I don't know, like, punching bag sort of physique.
Yes, they
besides
do.
Us.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
Sea cows. Sea cows. That's right. Supposed to be very nice, though. Manatees are supposed to be great to meet. Really friendly, gentle.
Do you remember the first time you saw a manatee in person?
A manatee in person? Yeah, I do.
Me
I was on
too.
A boat in Florida.
I wasn't on a boat. I was standing.
Oh, that's right. It was on the. It was on the. It was Brian Merritt and Carol Howard's wedding.
Yes.
Right off the coast there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was the first time. You're right. Oh my.
Coming out of the water to witness the wedding. I don't think they signed the marriage license, but they were there as witnesses.
What does a manatee sound?
I don't know.
Moo.
It's as good a guess as any, really.
Well, that wedding, or that wedding, that marriage has lasted, so it's...
Yes, it has.
Perhaps. That's a key.
Ah, that's a good point. Well, you know what they say. Something borrowed, something blue, something old, something manatee. Most couples have a hard time finding something manatee, but Carol pulled it off.
It's nice if you can borrow a manatee.
That's right. Yeah, just... two birds with one stone then.
Right. If you borrow an old one, that's even better. Hey, I've got this old manatee. Do you need it for your wedding?
I do.
Oh. Yeah, that would be perfect.
That would be perfect.
Can I paint it blue?
It's going to be all of these things in one. Well, how is it new? Well, it didn't used to be blue. That's new.
Probably never been in a wedding before. It seems new to invite a sea cow to your wedding.
That was a good wedding.
It was.
Yes. It was. All right. And now we managed to link together that beautiful wedding and manatee flatulence. Look at what we did.
I'm not so sure that the principals in that wedding would mind.
I think they'll be okay. All right. Well, if you're still listening, that probably means that you got the heavily edited version of this week's episode.
Or you fell asleep and you woke up at the end.
Or possibly tied to a piece of furniture. In which case... Just go to our Facebook page, which is Sons of the Double Cheeseburger, and leave a message that you're tied to a piece of furniture, and we'll help you get your freedom.
Or you can send us a letter at our new offices.
Did we have to move the office again this week?
We did. Sons of the Double Cheeseburger, P.O. Box 1, Hungry Horse, Montana. 59919.
All right. Was this the reason for the move, was this coronavirus related?
Probably.
Okay. All right. Hungry Horse, Montana. All right.
Yep.
What was the P.O. Box number again?
1. It's a small town.
We got a prime real estate. I like that. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Actually, and you know, something interesting about Hungry Horse, Montana.
Other than the fact that they're getting our mail?
It would be interesting if they got any mail. No, there is a allusion to Hungry Horse in Twin Peaks.
Really?
Yeah, there is.
I did not know that.
I did not know that. Who is that?
I believe that's Ed McMahon, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or Ed McMahon? Story for another time.
Depends on how you want to say it.
Depends.
Do you want to say it correctly?
Who knows exactly how you pronounce that? I don't think anyone knows. I don't think there's any way to know.
Oh, you're impersonating somebody. I've heard it both ways. I've
heard it both ways.
A lot of people are saying.
A lot of people are saying that.
McMahon. It's in Flathead County. Ooh. It had been called Dantown, and then they changed it to Hungry Horse.
Wait, I think we actually had a glitch. It was called what?
Damtown. In 1948, Flathead County Commissioners changed the name of the newly formed Damtown to Hungry Horse. The name comes from a local legend about two horses, Tex and Jerry, that escaped and almost starved to death in deep snow along the South Fork of the Flathead River.
And didn't Tex and Jerry at any point say, maybe we should go into that damn town and get some food?
They should have. There's a Hungry Horse Dam. The town was built to accommodate the workers that were building the Hungry Horse Dam.
Are the horses in the dam?
I don't know that the horses are around any longer.
Okay.
So...
I also love the fact that it's in Montana and one of the horses is named Tex.
Tex, and was it Larry?
Jerry,
sorry. So in the television series Twin Peaks, a giant tells Special Agent Dale Cooper that Leo Johnson was once, quote, locked inside a hungry horse, end quote. Cooper later found out that Johnson had once been locked up in a jail in Hungry Horse, Montana.
Wow. So that's where our mail is going this week, folks.
It is.
We look forward to reading your mail. We share our viewer mail every, or listener mail every week. So far, we haven't shared any.
It might be because it's being sent to...
Yeah, we're still trying to get it from... where was it last week?
Something with an M, right?
Double M's. Yeah, you know, once we move, I put it in the past.
And we were in King of Prussia at one point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It might still be lost in King of Prussia.
They're probably forwarding it.
Okay,
it's good. Fine. There's also an arboretum there devoted entirely to larch trees.
Larch trees?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's, yeah.
Well, that sounds great. All right. Well, thank you for listening, everybody.
Yes, and, thank you. We'll try harder next time.
I think this might have represented us trying hard. We worked
too hard.
We will try less hard next time. And until then, maintain a nice... safe distance from people, unless you live in Georgia or Texas, in which case just get up against somebody.
Dig a hole. Just keep digging down. Stay away from everyone.
That's right.
Because it's going to get ugly.
Indeed. Alrighty.
I don't like this ending.
Until next time.
All right.
Bye-bye.